Well, as you can see, everything is according to plan. On the whole, we're happy with the economic situation. And what's most important, this month, I'm very happy that I'm going to meet, as you have just pointed out, my friend, Prime Minister Narendra Modi. We agreed to meet in India a long time ago. There's a lot to talk about because the range of our cooperation with India is very huge. I'm not even talking about history of our relations because this history is of a unique nature. And I would also like to point out that the path that India has traveled since gaining its independence, just over the 77 years, which is a very short span in the scale of history, and India has managed to travel a great way. And I'm going to dwell on that a little bit later. But, you know, when we live our daily lives, we hardly notice the changes that are currently afoot. It rarely happens when we notice these changes. But if we have a look back at the history, we'll see that what transpired in India is, to a large extent, a miracle. Well, I don't think there are many people living in India who know that the longevity, the life expectancy in India over the 77 years has more than doubled.
In some time from now.
Yes, we're certainly going to talk about that. But be that as it may, our relations with India are developing across different ranges, different avenues. I'm very happy to have this chance to meet Prime Minister Modi. And not just business ties, but also personal ties bring us together.
You just talked about the Indo-Russian ties, and it dates back to almost more than seven decades. Dosti in Hindi and Druzba in Russian. This friendship dates back to more than seven decades. My question to you is, how do you assess the strength of this friendship in today's time? And what would you say about Prime Minister Narendra Modi and to Prime Minister Narendra Modi, whom you call your dost?
About Prime Minister Modi, the world is changing rapidly, and these changes are getting even faster, and everyone sees that very well. The world configuration is shifting, new poles of power are appearing, the configuration of forces across the world is shifting as well. And amid these conditions, it is very important to ensure stability between great nations. This stability is imperative because it creates a foundation, a solid basis for steady development, both bilaterally and globally. So in that sense, what we're doing together with Prime Minister Modi is of great significance, which goes beyond our bilateral relations. Moreover, when it touches directly upon our ties. And the thing is, the stability in certain spheres of cooperation is very important because this is the guarantee that we will achieve the goals that we have set before ourselves. And Prime Minister Modi has set before himself, before the government, before the country, enormous goals. Well, let's take Make in India, his great idea. It has practical manifestations even our bilateral ties. When we meet, he says, let's do this, let's do that, in this field, in that field, let's have a look at this and at that. And I'll be happy to name these fields. So there are many practical avenues of cooperation between ours.
The next question, one little small, very interesting question, because when you met Prime Minister Narendra Modi in SCO, and there was this picture and video of you and him going in a car, I mean, you're showing it to our viewers right now. You were traveling in a car with him. Was it pre-planned, or how did it go about? How did it happen, and what did you discuss in the car?
Well, we were talking about just the current agenda. It was not pre-planned. We just went outside into the street, and my car was there, and I suggested that we should get together just, you know, as a sign of friendship, of comradeship. There's nothing, no complicated orchestration just as France. We got together in one car and we spoke along the road. There was always something to talk about. And, you know, we had a conversation. We even sat in the car for quite some time. And then I said, yes, we should go because they're waiting for us. But there's nothing special about that. It just testifies to the fact that there's a lot we have to talk about. And these topics are of importance to us.
Right. President, sir. The fact that you're going to go to India, you just said that both leaders are going to cement the guarantees that you give each other. What are the kind of announcements that we can expect? We've heard about technology transfer. We've heard about trade enhancement. What are the solid announcements during this visit? And I ask you this is because the world, and you know who I mean, would be watching.
Well, the world is going to be watching. I don't think there's anything special about that because, you know, India is a great country, 1.5 billion people. It's a developing economy with a rate of growth of 7.7%. This is the first result in the world. Prime Minister Modi has managed to achieve that, and this is a lot the Indian nation can take pride in. There's all to be proud of. Of course, there are always detractors, critics who believe that this can be done better, but that said, the result is evident. We've got a whole plan for cooperation which covers the most important spheres and fields. The most important ones are certainly oriented towards the future, and one of them is high technology. India and Russia are working together in outer space exploration, in energy, nuclear energy in particular, which is well known because, you know, we are one of the leaders in that field, also shipbuilding, aircraft building. We have very many interesting directions which are oriented towards the future. Or let's take artificial intelligence. We'll probably talk about that later. But this is one of the key technologies of the future, which is reshaping the world as we speak, because it manages to multiply things many-fold, but at the same time, it creates certain challenges to be addressed. And we'll talk about all of that. And as Prime Minister Modi thinks and what I think, well, we'll choose what is of the greatest significance at this stage and will help for that. Well, of course, but we should probably not announce them right now because, you know, all of that is going to be announced in the course of the visit. We will present that to the public. And then the colleagues will present all of these agreements to us and we'll have to give our final approval to these agreements.
Okay. Just talking about sustainability and trade, there is immense pressure on India and on Russia when it comes to oil. India has suffered in terms of the kind of pressure that we're seeing from West. How can both countries handle this Western pressure and sanctions?
The thing is, this pressure you've just mentioned is mostly about using political instruments for simple economic competition purposes. In other words, our energy cooperation with India is not subject to short-term political fluctuations, nor is it connected to the tragic events in Ukraine. As far as hydrocarbons are concerned, our economic operators, the companies, long before the developments in Ukraine, had entered into very good, efficient relations based on trust. Trade relations, economic relations. One of our big companies, as is well known, has acquired an oil refinery in India. It was one of the biggest foreign investment into the Indian economy, to the tune of more than $20 billion. Our company is developing this refinery, working with its partners quite successfully too, year in, year out. and India became one of the big suppliers of oil products to the European markets, not just because it was buying our oil at a discount. The thing is, those ties go back years and decades before, and right now some don't like it that India occupies one of the leading positions in the markets thanks to its cooperation with Russia, and they're trying to devise a way in order to restrain India. They're trying to do that artificially, politically, shutting down opportunities for development.
An important point to make, but my question to you now would be about defense. And India continues to be the biggest defense buyer, roughly 38% of the market from Russia is bought by India. My question to you, sir, is in view of the sanctions by the US or the tariffs they have laid on India, the arm-twisting methods that are being adopted, and I name it's America, how do you plan to circumvent all this? Will you pull back or push harder?
Well, I think both the world and India have seen that one cannot talk to India the way they used to talk to it 77 years ago. India is a great power, not an English or British colony, and everyone will have to take that into account. And moreover, the head of the Indian government, Prime Minister Modi, is not one to give in to pressure. The Indian nation can take pride in their Prime Minister. It's absolutely evident Prime Minister Modi has a firm position, which is not, however, confrontational, nor are we going to enter into confrontation with anyone. We are simply trying to defend our legitimate interests, and that is exactly what India is doing. What are the obstacles? There's transactions and payments, but more than 90% of our transactions are carried out in national currencies. There are certain difficulties, of course, because there are intermediaries, but there are solutions to that, because we can transition to using the systems for financial messaging systems, which we have offered by the Bank of Russia and by our Indian counterparts. And we are doing this work steadily. And those who are taking steps to limit the economic cooperation of third parties sooner or later will incur losses. And I think once this understanding settles in completely and fully, then this practice of pressure from outside is going to come to an end.
Number one, because during Operation Sindoor, the weapons we had acquired from Russia proved very crucial in our victory. And that is why I would like to ask you specifically about S-400, the air defense system, the five S-400s that are awaited by, when can we expect that? The second question is on S-500, the more advanced air defense system. And the third question, fifth generation fighter jet, Su-57. How are you going to push for this and what's the update, sir?
Well, you're an expert in this field. It's as if we were at the negotiating table on military and technical cooperation. But, you know, if we look a substantive look at that, then I will tell you that India is one of our reliable partners with whom we have a greatest level of trust. We are not simply selling things to India. India is not simply buying things in defense. The thing is, this relation with India is of a different nature, of a different character, and of a different level, and this is something we cherish, just as India cherishes that. We are not simply selling, we are also sharing technology. And this is a very rare case in military and technological cooperation, which attests to the high level of trust between our two countries. And the thing is, there is a wide range of products in shipbuilding, military shipbuilding, missile building, aircraft building. You've just mentioned Su-57. But India also operates other Russian aircraft. Or let's remember the production of armored vehicles like T-90 tanks produced by India, and this is one of the best tanks. And there was also the BrahMos missiles, which we managed to manufacture together with India and which have been manufactured in Indian production opportunities. So make in India by... Well, yes, Kalashnikov, this is also an important weapon, of course, but we are talking about high technology, even cutting-edge technology, if I go as far as to say that. And given the use of certain types of weaponry in combat, their value has increased manifold. And right now, Indian military experts understand full well, given their contacts with the Russian military, what and in what conditions is most efficient, what has to be employed and used and where and in what fashion. And this is of paramount importance for our military and for the experts. And there's this understanding both on the Russian side and on the Indian side.
I have to go back to your oil question, because you spoke about strategic autonomy, which is what India has been talking about. Strategic autonomy, decide for India's interests. But has India reduced Russian intake of oil after pressure from the West?
Well, you know, there is a certain decrease in bilateral trade over the first 9 months of this year. This is just a minor adjustment. But on the whole, our bilateral trade stands almost at the same level as it used to. I cannot cite concrete figures right now, month in, month out, but trade in hydrocarbons, in oil products for customers in particular, is being done steadily. I know the sentiment among the Russian partners, the Russian companies. They believe that their Indian counterparts are reliable and very serious people.
The other important aspect in terms of cooperation between India and Russia is the nuclear front. Russia has been one of the biggest movers when it comes to nuclear facilities in India. Are we looking at important announcements on the nuclear front? Nuclear today is a sensitive issue for Russia.
Yes.
Yes, we have some announcement to make. Of course there are. Indeed, we're one of the largest stakeholders. Well, not stakeholders, so to speak. We're producers of the cutting-edge and most reliable in the world equipment for nuclear power plants. Russian company called Rosatom is ranking number one in the world in building and producing of nuclear reactors for NPPs abroad, 22 nuclear units. The famous nuclear power plant Kudam-Kulam is one of the leaders in this regard. These are large units. They're working effectively. And I can repeat myself that they have proven to be very useful. There are news in terms of what you've been asking. What are these news? The news means that possibly Russia is possibly one of the countries, the only country in the world that is capable of producing and produces small power plants, SMRs. They are already in use in Russia. And actually, we can produce them as a land-based option and a sea option, a floating option. This is a very good possibility. For certain areas, it can be used very efficiently when there is no need to build a major power plant and later bring transmission lines from the generation facility to the consumer. And you can put such SMRs in hard-to-reach areas. You can put small plants there.
That's a lot of collaboration and cooperation. We're talking about made in India, make with Russia. How do you think President Trump is going to react to all of this?
You know, neither I nor Prime Minister Modi, though we experience certain external pressure, have never, and I would like you to hear this, we've never built our work, our joint work, against anyone. President Trump has his own policy, his own tasks, and we're solving our own issues, not against someone, but for us, ensuring the interests of India and Russia. But we're not hurting anyone with our cooperation. I think that leaders of other countries should appreciate that.
With regard to Mr. Donald Trump, my second question is also about him, because recently he also went on to say that if you're buying oil from Russia, you're the one about India, you're the one who's funding the Russia-Ukraine war. How would you characterize Mr. Donald Trump, the President of the United States of America?
You know, I never give characteristics to my colleagues. Even to those colleagues, to counterparts who I used to work before, especially for the incumbent heads of state. And such evaluation should be given by the citizens who have voted for the leader during the election campaign. As for the purchasing of energy from Russia on behalf of India, I would like to highlight that, and I've said it before publicly, the U.S. continued to buy the nuclear fuel from us for their NPPs. That is also fuel, energy. This is uranium for nuclear power plants that are functioning in the U.S. That means that if the U.S. has the right to purchase fuel from us, why India should be deprived of such a right? That is a matter to be studied closely, and we're prepared to discuss that and debate that with President Trump as well.
But you're being very kind. You're saying you do not characterize Trump, but he certainly does to you. Having said that, he has weaponized tariffs, and he's weaponized it against India. Right now you're engaged, but it's a blow-hot, blow-cold for India. How do you think the two countries should be handling Donald Trump and the U.S. administration?
You know, he's conducting his own policy. And I assume that he has counselors. He's not just taken this from the sky. He has advisors who believe that conducting such a tariff policy that has to do with introduction of additional tariffs against their counterparts in the end brings dividends to the U.S. economy, and he does that very sincerely, I believe. Our experts believe that there is a certain danger. However, that's a choice of the country and the leader of that or other country, what kind of economic policy to choose. We've never done that, and we don't intend to do that. We have an open economy, and we hope that in the end, all violations that have to do with the rules of the WTO will be amended.
Things have changed a little between U.S. and Russia. The fact that America is engaging you, we would have loved to be a fly on the wall when you were meeting with Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff. That was an important meeting. Were there red lines that Russia reiterated? What really happened?
It's premature to talk about that. I don't think it would be interesting for you to be a fly on the wall. It lasted for 5 hours. I got bored with it, too. But it was necessary. Yes. Yes, and I was alone. Imagine that. What a disgrace. But if we speak on a more serious note, it was a very useful meeting. Because the fact that our U.S. colleagues brought with them, it was based more or less on our agreements before my meeting with President Trump in Alaska. In this way or another, we've discussed these issues during the meeting in Anchorage. But the fact that they brought to us today, we haven't seen that before. So that meant we had to go item by item. That is why it took so much time. Therefore, it was a necessary conversation. It was very specific, very meaningful.
Okay, can I ask this question this way, sir? Was there a certain specific point where you disagreed? Was there a specific point of disagreement where the one versus one was just not going forward?
Yes, there are issues that there was disagreement. We've discussed it. This is complex work, a complex mission that President Trump has taken upon himself. Indeed, I say it without any irony, because achieving that both conflicting parties come to a consensus, that's a complex task. Indeed, and I'm sure that President Trump sincerely is trying to do that. Therefore, we went item by item. I repeat that. Somewhere we said that, yes, that is to be discussed. This we cannot agree with. That was the discussion. That was the manner we talked about. But saying specifically what does not suit us or what we could live with, I think it's premature at this point, because this can simply disrupt that manner of work that President Trump is trying to organize. What they're doing right now is shuttle diplomacy. They've talked to the representatives of Ukraine. Now they've talked to the Europeans. Then they travel to us. Later they have a meeting with the Ukrainians and Europeans again. I think they need to engage in this work and not stand in the way.
So you're saying the 28-point peace proposal is now not on the table, but there were leaked conversations?
It is on the table. We are discussing it. They simply broken down this 28 and later 27 points into four packages.
Okay.
And they suggested we discuss four packages, but in essence, these are the same 27 points.
I understand how it's going forward, sir. But what happened in Alaska? You met President Trump, and it was all about the peace deal, right? What happened? Did anything come out of it? Did you actually see a clear and sincere intent?
Yes, it was indeed so. We had a feeling, and even more than a feeling, I had no doubt that President Trump has sincere desire. Well, let's not talk about what's the cause of it, but what dictated this sincere desire, but it is there, in place, for sure. The United States and President Trump, indeed, they have their own understanding of why it needs to end, and as soon as possible. Incidentally, humanitarian issues. I firmly believe that this is one of the causes, one of the reasons behind President Trump's behavior on that, because he always is saying that, and I'm sure it's sincere, that he wants to minimize the losses. And I'm sure that he also has humanitarian notions about that. But there are other ideas, both political and economic. And I'm sure that the U.S. are trying to find a solution.
Right. He has spoken about intentions. You're right about that. You know, he's claimed to have ended wars. He's been claiming, much to India's disappointment, that he brought about or brokered a ceasefire between India and Pakistan. And now he's looking at Russia, Ukraine. He's looking at Israel. Do you really think Trump is a peacemaker?
Well, in case that of the situation in Ukraine, for sure. Yes, I can repeat once again, I'm positive. I have no doubt that he sincerely strives to find a peaceful solution. And I can highlight once again, the United States might have different reasons for it, both humanitarian notions personally for President Trump, because indeed he would like to the end of hostilities and loss of life. But he could have political interests as well for the end of standoff between Russia and Ukraine, and economic reasons as well, incidentally, in energy sphere, for example, and in other spheres as well. There are many dimensions where restoring of economic relations between the United States and Russia would benefit both countries, both Russia and the United States. He has shown me some letters. I will not be talking in detail about that, but some letters from major U.S. companies to us.
Really?
So,
yes. The letters that there are U.S. companies, that they exist, and they prepare to come back when all issues have been lifted, and want to do that, and please don't forget about them. On paper. Well, there is nothing so surprising. Why are you so surprised? Many want to come back to Russia. The Indian government are also telling us, why should we leave?
For Trump to make the bidding, to come with companies, letters from companies, that's a different ballgame altogether.
No, you misunderstood me. We have letters from American companies. We already have letters from the U.S. companies that have been sent to us. And they're asking us not to forget about them. They're our partners. They did not leave of their own volition. They're waiting for a political signal.
This conversation is becoming very interesting, sir, because there are so many highlights of understanding, and it's really pleasant to see you and your sense of humor and how you're putting things forth. But now we'll go on to a very serious matter, and that is the Russia-Ukraine war. So what, in your view, would constitute a victory for Russia in the Russia-Ukraine war? What are the red lines? Because you have, and I quote you, you have said very clearly that Russia will lay down arms only if Kyiv's troops withdraw from territory claimed by Russia. Which parts would that be?
You know, it's not about the victory, as you said. It's about the fact that Russia is trying to defend, and will do that. Will defend our interests, our people who live there. The defense and protection of our values, traditional values, the Russian language, and so on. And the defense of religion, of faith that has been there for centuries on those territories. You know that the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine is basically banned. They're requisitioning churches and people thrown out of temples. I'm not even talking about the ban on the Russian language. That is the comprehensive set of issues. I'd like to remind you once again, we were not the ones who started the war. The West connived at Ukraine and organized the coup d'etat in Ukraine, later followed by the events in Crimea and later in the southeast of Ukraine, then Ukraine, Donbass. It's not being discussed. For 8 years, eight long years, we've been trying to solve that issue through peaceful means. We've signed a peaceful settlements, the Minsk agreement, in the hope that it will be possible to use the peaceful means to settle the issue. Later, we learned that the Western leaders, who said that publicly, they've never intended to fulfill the Minsk agreements, and they've signed them only to give a chance to arm Ukraine and to continue the armed fight against us. So we were forced, after 8 years of this killing of people who live in Donbass, and no one is remembering that in the West. We were forced to recognize the republics first, and second, we had to provide support to them. And our special military operation is not the beginning of the war. It's an attempt to end it, to end the war that the West has started against us at the hands of Ukrainian nationalists. That is what's happening in reality. That is the crux of the matter. And we'll end this war when we decide that we have achieved the goals that we have set before the beginning of the special military operation. We'll liberate the territories.
What is the end game for Vladimir Putin in Ukraine?
Well, I've just said it. We have recognized, listen, for 8 years we did not recognize the self-declared republics. For 8 years, they have declared their independence, and we were trying to build relations between the rest of Ukraine and these republics. When we understood that it's impossible, that they're simply being destroyed, we were forced to recognize them, and not simply recognize them in as their partial territory, but within the administrative borders, when they existed back in the Soviet times. And later, during the times of the independent Ukraine, after it gained independence, in the administrative limits, lines, and so the people, the voters, came to the referendum and voted for everyone to withdraw troops from there and not to conduct any armed actions there, but they preferred to wage war. And now it all came to a head, and it all comes to one thing. Either we do that through military action, we'll liberate the territories, or the Ukrainian troops will withdraw and leave these territories and stop killing people there.
Before we move to the other one, just one last question, sir. March 8, 2014, during the annexation of Crimea, you were addressing the Federation Council, and you said, Kyiv is the mother of all Russian cities. Yeah. What did you mean?
You know, I've never invented anything. That was the historic saying. The Russian state was initially built from different centers. The first capital, according to the historical data, was situated around Novgorod city in the northwest. Later, the statehood moved to the state of Veliki, to the city of Veliki Novgorod, later to Kiev. That was the ancient Rus. And since then, Kiev was called the mother of Russian cities. Later, the tide of history turned, and there was a division of the ancient Russian state. The part of a single ancient Russian state started to develop with a center in Moscow, and a different part of it landed with other countries. For example, the part with Kiev and some other lands, these lands were first a part, well, they had formed a state with Lithuania, later united with Poland, was a part of the Polish state. So that part of ancient Russian state ended in Poland, and in the 17th century wanted to go back to Russia.
The fact that, you know, you're mentioning the history, and it brings me to what I did when the conflict was underway. I had traveled to Donetsk, I traveled to Luhansk, Zaporizhia, Kherson, and most of the people over there are Russian speaking. They speak Russian language. They were very disappointed with Kyiv that it was banned in eastern Ukraine. But they were also a little shocked that how is Putin doing this to us? We are his people. A lot of women I spoke to were in shock. So what do you have to say to people in eastern Ukraine who actually have families in Russia, who on a daily basis move from Ukraine to Russia? So what do you have to say to them?
Well, I didn't quite catch the question. What were you shocked by?
That they were shocked that there was an operation that happened and their homes were destroyed because they lived in eastern Ukraine and they have love for Russia and the Russian people, and they're Russian-speaking themselves.
The answer is very simple. The thing is, they were living in that part of Ukraine, in Luhansk or Donetsk Republic, that had been under control of the Kyiv authorities. But that part of Donetsk or Luhansk region, they had been destroyed by the Kyiv regime that were not under their control. And because of that destruction, we had to give our support to those parts of Donetsk and Luhansk that declared their independence. We gave a chance to people to speak their mind during the referendum, and those who wanted to be with Russia, they voted in favor, and those who were against that, they could have easily left to other parts of the Ukrainian state. We didn't prevent them from doing that.
What do you make of President Zelensky? He was promised NATO. The European Union promised him EU. Nothing really happened. Was NATO ever on the table for Ukraine?
When this sir came to power, he said that he would do everything for the sake of peace, that he would sacrifice everything, even his career, for the sake of peace. But as you can see in hindsight, it all looks different. Just as his predecessors, he began to be guided not by Ukrainian interests, by the interests of a very small group of radical nationalists, and he's basically serving their interests. This regime, by its very mindset, is very much similar to a neo-Nazi regime because there are, you know, radical forms of nationalism and neo-Nazism. This is basically one and the same, almost identical. And right now they're basically waging war. This regime is pursuing war. And it's not doing that well. But as I said before, the most important thing for them is to come to the realization that the best solution to this problem is to agree at the negotiating table about what we tried to secure back in 2022. But you have to ask them what they intend to do.
It'll be interesting to see what they have to say on that and how this peace process goes forward. But, sir, you've always said that the eastward expansion of NATO is your real concern. Now, Ukraine hasn't got this NATO membership as of now. My question to you, sir, is NATO expansion the real threat or just a pretext for what you think is a part of Ukraine which is probably you want control over? Or you think that injustice is being done, Russian language is being banned? These were the real issues.
Well, listen. NATO, well, it's a different topic entirely. Russian culture, Russian language, religion, and even territorial matters. These are all important matters, but these are one thing, whereas NATO is a different thing. And we're not demanding anything exclusive, anything unprecedented. There is a principle according to which the security of one country cannot be ensured at the expense of another country. This is a theory. Well, probably it's obtuse or abstruse, very difficult to understand, but I will explain that in simple terms. They say that any country, even including Ukraine, has the means to choose what means to employ to ensure their security, and we do not deny that right to Ukraine. But the thing is, this security should not be guaranteed at the expense of Russia's security. Ukraine thinks it better to join NATO, whereas we say that if that were the case, it would present a danger to our security. So let's search for a way that will ensure your security on the one hand, but on the other hand is not going to present a threat to us. Moreover, we're not insisting on anything, we're not demanding anything that would be unprecedented or wouldn't have roots in history. We are simply insisting on the promises that had been given to us should be observed. We didn't come up with that yesterday, you know. The thing is, this promise had been given to Russia, to the Soviet Union even, back in the 1990s, not an inch to the east. That is what they said. And after that, there has been several waves of NATO expansion, and right now, and then they came to trying to induct Ukraine into NATO. We're not simply disappointed with that or irritated because, you know, NATO is a military bloc. No, Article 4-5, I think, is still very much in place, the Washington Treaty, but no one wants to take our concerns into account. Moreover, when Ukraine gained its independence, very often it's forgotten, but one of the first documents that was adopted when independence was declared was the Declaration of Neutrality. And this is the basis for the current statehood of Ukraine, that is the Declaration of Sovereignty of Ukraine, which states that it's neutral.
Was that also the basis for what happened when you decided to annex Crimea, your only warm water port, a very important strategic port for Russia, and then Russia was no longer part of G8? Today, the West claims or says that your actions in the recent past is the reason for, and I quote unquote, the isolation of Russia.
Well, you know, we didn't have to get that important port because this port had already belonged to us, basically. Our Navy, under treaty with Ukraine, had been stationed at this port in Sevastopol. These are just the facts. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, our Navy was still stationed there. Of course, it was important. But, you know, the thing is, we didn't annex Crimea, and I would like to underline that. We simply came to help those people who didn't want their future to have anything to do with the people who orchestrated the coup d'etat in Kiev. These people in Crimea said, yes, these nationalists had conducted a coup d'etat in Kiev. Had we been consulted? Well, yes, we ended up, they said, as part of independent Ukraine after the collapse of the Soviet Union. These were just historical facts, very well. But we believe that it's a democratic state. And if a coup d'etat happens in a democratic state and the consequences of that coup unknown, we don't want to live like that. That's the reasoning of the people in Crimea. And there was a threat, not just of pressure, but also that Crimeans would be persecuted and Russia came to their assistance. And if someone thinks otherwise, thinks that Russia is gonna act in another fashion, then they are very much mistaken. We will always protect our interests.
Just ask one brief question before we move on to the other part. Do you want to go back to being a part of the G8? Because that's a lot. There are a lot of reports on that. So is that something that Russia is looking at?
No.
That's an interesting answer, sir. You're very clear about that.
Well, yes. Well, I'm not going into detail, but I basically stopped going to these meetings back in the past. That's the first thing. Secondly, I can hardly understand why countries of the G7 call themselves G7, you know, in Russia it's called G, like for great, big. The thing is, India's economy and purchasing power ranks third. And what about the UK or other countries in terms of purchasing parity capacity? I think it's the 10th place or something like that. I don't remember. But yes, these countries have a high-tech economy with a very solid foundation, which is still very much there, even though their share and the world economy is shrinking year in, year out. Inexorably. And the trend is there, and it's going to persist, apparently. Well, let's put it mildly. I think this is going to happen due to the erroneous policy pursued by the authorities of many of these countries. Let's have a look at the recession in Germany. It's very much there for the third year in a row. France is in a very difficult spot right now on the brink of recession, and the same applies to other leading European economies. But that said, the G7 is still an important platform. They are working on something, discussing things, making some decisions. Good health to them and all the best. But, you know, at a certain point in time, I simply stopped going to these meetings. And it was not due to developments in Ukraine. These were due to other events, other developments. I'm not going to go into detail right now. And, you know, we informed our American counterparts on that and on.
Sir, you informed them in this meeting, during this meeting?
In IT too.
Yes, this meeting in particular.
With Mr. Witkoff?
Yes, we mentioned this topic.
Oh, that's a very important aspect to it. But you have visited China.
Think? Well, I don't think that is that important, but if you think so.
Okay, sir. So coming back to, I just want to put it in perspective before we go ahead. So you're just telling us that in your recent meeting with Mr. Witkoff, it was offered to you that you could make it back to G8, and you categorically said that you are not interested.
Нет, нет, нет.
Okay, sir.
No, this topic simply came up. You know, I had explained it to Mr. Witkoff why I had stopped visiting G8 meetings in the past. Well, there was no proposal. No proposal came, but we simply broached the subject. And I remembered that point in time when I stopped coming, that was back in 2012, after the presidential elections in the Russian Federation. Then I came at a certain point in time, and then I didn't. Well, it's a platform. Okay, very well, let it work further. But, you know, other big associations are coming up, like BRICS, the SCO, and the G20 is still active, and we are participating in one of these formats. We don't have any objections against all of that. But, you know, let's have a look at another aspect. What is the current state of affairs in relations between Russia and the EU? They're not normal. So imagine I go to the G8. How am I supposed to be talking to the members of the G8 if they don't want to talk to me? What am I supposed to do there? Well, we'll probably talk about that later.
You just made, number one, you're saying that countries like India, whose growth rate is far exceeding a lot of European countries, need to just calm down and understand how things are moving. The other thing you say is that organizations like probably G7 are losing their relevance, and what do I do there if they don't want to talk to me? But the third thing also you mentioned is BRICS. Now, my question to you, sir, is there a new world order falling in place? Because you're not going to G7, but you just visited China, and you're about to visit India. Russia, India, China, RIC, BRICS, SCO, Global South. What do you see as the new power center in the multipolar world?
You've asked whether the world is changing, whether a new world order is, in the stage of configuration. Well, the thing is, the world is constantly changing. Everything passes, everything changes, but right now the rate of these changes has skyrocketed, and we can feel that, we can see that. I mentioned that before. The thing is, we are witnessing global economic shifts and changes. They are not related to the developments in Ukraine or elsewhere where conflicts are happening. I think we can spend another hour speaking about that. It would give me great pleasure, but unfortunately, your audience, they're going to be bored with our deliberations on the subject. But the fact remains the fact. New centers of development, rapid development, strong development are happening. They are forming in the Global South in particular. I refer to South Asia. And not just India, but also Indonesia is on the ascendancy. I think it's almost 300 million people, not 1.5 billion as in India, but still this is a rapidly developing country. The same goes for Africa, which is developing rapidly. And this development is going to pick up because there are young people living there, and theirs is the future, and they will seek a higher standard of living. So this is inevitable. The rate of changes in the global economy is only going to grow further. Incidentally, we often hear that recently Russia is readjusting, recalibrating its ties with the Global South or with Asia. Well, far be from me to say that. We've been doing that since 2000s.
President, sir, this picture actually ruffled a lot of feathers across the world.
The Russia and the China.
Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, and Narendra Modi. Three nation heads together. And people were going all over social media and America.
But even if you look at that picture, President, sir, how do you have these alternative blocs, and how can they become a real force if there are fundamental unresolved issues between key member states in that bloc?
Well,
The thing is, conflicts are always there, they're always present. There was not a point in time where there had been no conflict. Let's have a look at the background of major regions, major centers of the world. Whether you look at any point in history, you will see that there are always questions, always conflicts. The most important thing is how do you go about finding a solution to the conflict? How do you go about finding the most efficient method of addressing these challenges? Let's take BRICS and other large associations like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And the thing is, within these organizations, we have a common understanding of what brings us together, and that is our values. Traditional values, on the basis of which our civilizations have existed for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And based upon these values handed over to us from previous generations, we're trying to advance and move forward, bringing our efforts together rather than trying to repress these opportunities. And when you pull efforts together, then the end result is based on synergy, and it turns out to be unprecedentedly good, unprecedentedly impressive. And this is what we are prioritizing within these associations and organizations. There was not a single time when we got together to find a way of trying to dupe someone or, you know, preventing someone's development. Our agenda is always of a positive nature. And I think this is important.
Okay, so that's an important answer. But are there alternatives? Because the biggest thing when you have these blocks is how do you make it economically viable? Are we looking at alternative payment systems? Is there going to be a BRICS currency? Or are we looking at alternative payments in terms of national currencies? Rupee, ruble.
Moving towards de-dollarization, basically.
Well, you know, there is no need for haste. And if there is no hurry, then you will avoid many grave mistakes. Let's have a look at Europe. They created the euro system, and they involved in that eurozone several countries that were economically unprepared for a single currency. Hence, problems with regulating a number of issues related to social system. You know, you cannot simply work with the national currency because there is one single currency, hence problems with the budget. We do not have this goal of building a single currency in BRICS at this stage and point. This has to be done very carefully, prudently.
And we need to use national currencies. We need to use wider the capacity of the new development bank of BRICS. For example, we've proposed to create a new investment platform that would use electronic payments with a minimum capital of $100 billion to begin with, in order to create conditions for joint investment both in our economy and the economies of the developing global south. I assume it could be very interesting because these are investments that could foster the growth in the economies of the recipient countries, and that would also benefit us because together with these countries we'd produce high-quality products at affordable prices that would help develop the global south countries and our development as well. And such payment tools could multiply. The modern means of electronics, for example, electronic payment means and electronic money exist, and they develop at a very fast pace. And this work is not aimed against anyone. This is simply fine-tuning of the tools that already exist in the world. And that's it. They're already in place.
The rupee-ruble payment here, then.
There
There is no obstacle there. This is a matter of economy. We fully understand that we have a certain imbalance in our trade. For example, the Indian government are not introducing any roadblocks in our joint trade because they need oil and oil products. The government of India requires a wider purchase of Russian fertilizers because these fertilizers are urgently needed for the agrarian sector in India. And Prime Minister Modi always sets this this issue before us that we need to increase the supply, please. It's not about rupees here or payments, but what could be bought with these rupees by our companies. And we're thinking about it. Not only the Indian government, but we also agree that this disparity should be amended, but not through bans, but through search of such spheres of business activity that would benefit both us and India. At our initiative, during my visit, we're going to hold a special expo of Russian importers from India, importers. And honestly, this was a direct decree by me to the Russian government to think through what could be additionally done in terms of purchasing from India, and we're thinking about it on both sides. Russia is also considering that.
If it goes forward, my next question to you, sir, before we move to other issues, is how do you balance? I'm going to ask that directly. How do you balance India and China? Because it is very clear that you're keen on good relations with both these countries. How do you balance them? Seeing some tensions between us.
We're fully aware of that. India and China are our closest friends, and we cherish that. And we don't think that we have the right to interfere in the bilateral relations between India and China. I know that Prime Minister Modi and President Xi are striving and they're finding solutions to all interstate issues, even most complex ones. I know about that both from Prime Minister Modi and President Xi. Both leaders are worried and concerned about the growing tension. And they apply every effort, maximum effort, and I see that and I'm aware of that. They apply every effort to find solutions to all issues. And most importantly, they succeed thanks to their wisdom, and we're very happy about that. But we don't think that we have the right to interfere. These are bilateral relations.
The next important issue with regard to India, sir, is terrorism. We faced two major terror attacks, one in Pahalgam and then one in Delhi. My question to you is that we see a dual ideology on terror in the world from different countries. What is the solution in your eyes? Because Russia has also faced terrorism. India faces it. What in your eyes is the solution to your terrorist, my freedom fighter ideology?
It's very simple. Terrorism. Well, you need to fight for freedom through legal means. Everything that has to do with bringing loss to people using the means of thugs cannot be supported. For us, this is an issue that has been long resolved. As you've mentioned, Russia has come across this issue during its most modern history with very cruel acts of terrorism. And we're complete allies with India, and we fully support India in its fight against terrorism.
Okay. But there's another country in the neighborhood, very important to Russia, important to India, Afghanistan. You are a very rare country to have recognized the Taliban regime. What made you really look at that as a strategic interest to recognize the Taliban at a time when the world is still saying They have not given equal rights to women, where there are still a lot of issues with Afghanistan actually coming to becoming a country that holds women and men equally. And there are many other human rights issues there.
Each country has sufficient issues in Afghanistan as well. I also mean the fact that for decades the country is at a state of civil war. And it's completely horrible. And Taliban controls the situation in Afghanistan. It is apparent. That's number one. That's just the reality that we need to consider. Number two, the government of Afghanistan is doing quite a lot in order to fight that very terrorism, terrorist organizations. Take, for example, the Islamic State and some other units of the same nature, and we know that very well. The leadership of Afghanistan has cut down the drug crops in the country, and they're taking some very active steps to curb the drug threat coming from the territory of Afghanistan. There are several other circumstances there. Most importantly, is that to have an impact of what's happening, you have to keep in touch. You have to work together. And we've been doing that.
The foreign minister of Afghanistan was in India. This I'm just sharing a snippet. He was in India, and we weren't allowed. Women weren't allowed to attend the press conference. And we fought back. And then he had to hold a press conference with women as part of that entire delegation. Isn't that interesting? I was just sharing it with you.
Look, if you didn't come to India, you wouldn't have a chance to impact that process. But with that, you have a contact, you keep in touch. The minister traveled out to India, and you responded to what you've seen with your own eyes, what's happening. Is this a lot? Is this little? But still, it's an impact on the situation among your partners. Let's imagine that you have no contact whatsoever. What then? It will just stay the same. And no one, and you, in this case, would have an impact, would not express your attitude towards that. And with that, you have an opportunity to do that. To have contact is better than none.
The other flashpoint is Gaza. And it is now being known that you, sir, Vladimir Putin, have a new peace plan for Gaza. Trump also has one. What is your Gaza peace plan, and what do you propose, sir?
We're not proposing any specific plan. We've always assumed that in order to solve the issue of Palestine, the solutions that have been adopted throughout many years by the United Nations need to be implemented. And most important one is to create an independent Palestinian state. That is key to solving all issues.
Okay. The other important issue when you talk about Israel and Gaza that Anjana just did is the fact that the Arab world, when it comes to the issue of Gaza and people of Palestine, did not really do as much as your ally, your friend Iran, did. How do you look at this entire scenario where this is a changed world order? We never thought that Iran would fight back for Palestinians more than the Arab world.
You know, each of these countries is concerned about Palestine and is partial to Palestinian nation, and each and every country is trying to make an effort to settle the situation. Some of the actions are very apparent, or some are public, some actions remain in the shadows, but it doesn't mean that someone is not doing anything. That's a very complex issue. I mean, for decades it remained unsolved. Therefore, solving it at the flip of your hand overnight, it's impossible. But we need to strive for that, to the creation of a Palestinian state. What was done now by President Trump, naturally, primarily, the return of hostages, of Israeli hostages, and Hamas took this step. I think, frankly speaking, this was the most important thing that was done as part of the latest steps for the settlement in Gaza. I believe it would be correct to maybe think about the possibility of organizing the governance, the authorities, to transfer all of the authorities to the Palestinians. There are such options. They have been discussed both by Arab countries and the neighbors, and beyond. It's been discussed in the United States as well, I know. And as part of the United Nations, we've always advocated, we've taken part in this process, and we'll continue to do that with our friends.
President Putin, we've discussed a lot of geopolitics. We'll stick to a bit of that in a while, but let's talk about your journey. You're a man from the intelligence community. How would you rate intelligence agencies today? Which one do you think is the best? I'm sure you'll say Russia, but I'm still saying, which one is the second best then? And how does CIA fare?
Well, there are several powerful intelligence services in the world, and CIA, and our Soviet and Russian intelligence. It is well known that a very efficient service is Mossad, Israeli intelligence. Many countries of the world have a tradition of intelligence services. I think it's best not to give evaluation to the efficiency of other people's intelligence, but I'm happy with the quality of work of my intelligence service.
Okay, fair enough. So we would like to, because this is a rare opportunity and we get to interact with you. We want to understand what shaped Vladimir Putin. And as we peep into your early years, we've read a little about your KGB days when you were working in Germany, and then you moved on to St. Petersburg, and then Moscow, where you worked with Mr. Yeltsin. What actually shaped the man you are today, the leader you are today? Which were the days?
My family. The family that I lived in and that I was born in. My parents. My closest people. My loved ones. And I think that's everyone is shaped by our closest surroundings. Naturally, the social situation around, the colleagues, and you've noted that working in the intelligence service, because it has strict discipline, strict ideology that primarily has to do with the defense of the interests of motherland. And everything, and that was the entire point of the intelligence service of the Soviet Union, and I lived in that system for many years.
I was watching one of your interviews where I think you were interacting with school children, and one of the children asked you, one girl there asked you, what has been the most shattering experience of your life? And you said, the disintegration of USSR. How did that affect you? And what is your vision of Russia?
It had an impact in the sense that we always need to very carefully look at our every step, and we need to understand the consequences of that. That's number one. Number two, it's very important. Not only for the Soviet Union, but it applies more to Russia. You know, what was the conclusion that I came to? Is that Soviet Union, at a certain point in time, was in such a state that, and its leadership, and possibly even regular citizens, always believed that it's so big, it's so great, that nothing ever, in any circumstance, would happen to it. And this idea of grandeur, that's when the country starts to make one mistake after another. thinking that it's too big to fail. Well, we're so big. It will all come to pass. We'll survive that mistake and another mistake. But the number of these mistakes snowballs, and it's very hard to manage that. And the same is happening with some other countries today.
Are you going to name them?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, but we go back to USSR, sir, because you talked about how one mistake was rolling into another. Who do you hold responsible for this situation? I mean, you're talking about people also who thought that probably it'll never happen with us. There'll never be any disintegration. But I'm sure you must have seen the Gorbachev years. You saw how Yeltsin went on. Whom do you hold responsible? What was the phase in which decisively USSR was disintegrating, breaking up?
I wouldn't try to pinpoint the guilty and who's to blame more or less. In general, that was the system that turned out not to be viable. We need to recognize that. And we need to think about that, not to look for specific culprits, but we need to think how to create a system that would not simply protect itself, but it would develop. That's the thing. And if such a system would be in place, then it will be self-sufficient and autonomous and effective.
Are you looking at reintegration then?
Reintegration of what? Of the Soviet Union? No, of course not. This is simply not on the table. We don't have such a goal, naturally. And it won't make any sense. There is also the meaning of, is something making sense? And in the current conditions, it does not make sense. Because it would critically change the national and religious composition of the Russian Federation. It does not make sense.
Tell that to some of the Western papers who keep writing about how you really want the old Soviet Union back. Because that's what they keep doing.
I won't tell it to them. You know why? Because they still don't want to listen what I'm saying. They want to listen to themselves only. Or they want to comment on what I'm saying the way they like it.
Yeah, they actually make a point, as Geeta said, and they start. They write a lot about saying that you want to build the empire back.
Yes, they do that in order to scare their population. They abuse their monopoly in the global media. It's called manipulation of public opinion. And the goal is to justify their aggressive policy towards Russia. And I'd say another goal.
How would you, Vladimir Putin, summarize Vladimir Putin's life and ideology?
It's too early for me to summarize my life. I have some work ahead of me.
Because we're going to talk about longevity, but before that, there's a very important question. You're going to India. The prime ministers of India have had a huge, huge role to play in this strengthening of India-Russia ties. Who do you think, in your span of being a leader here in Russia, really made that difference since you were in power in enhancing India-Russia ties? Which are the prime ministers?
You've asked me to characterize other leaders of other countries. You know, I don't think it's very decent. Well, now we're working with Prime Minister of India, His Excellency Narendra Modi. Indeed, we have a very trustworthy and friendly relation. He's a very reliable person. In that sense, I'm speaking very sincerely. India got lucky. He lives India. He breathes India. I'm talking to him and I know him. I hope he won't be cross with me. I'm just saying what I see and what I'm thinking. It's very pleasant to me to talk to such person, and that's number one. Number two, indeed, he very sincerely wants to strengthen Indian and Russian ties across the board, and especially crucial issues in defense, in economy, in humanitarian cooperation, in development of high tech. It's very interesting for me to meet with him. He traveled here, and we sat with him at my home, and we drank tea for a very long time, a whole evening. We spoke on different topics. We simply have an interesting conversation, purely like humans. So I'm waiting for this meeting, and I'm sure it will be very useful and interesting.
Sir, I'm sure he has this mutual admiration for you as well. Quick question on the future, sir, because AI is a force to reckon with. Your viewpoint on that, do you think it is a force for chaos or it's a force for good? And where is Russia in this AI weapon war that's like in a prep situation world over?
You know, just like any other achievement of progress, this could be both a good and evil. It's clear that this is a cross-cutting technology that changes the life of a regular person, and of course, in the nearest future, it will change the lives of the whole humanity. And those will be the first to introduce this technology most effectively would gain a tremendous benefit in economy, advantage in defense as well, and in every sphere, in education, in science, healthcare, everywhere. Because the effective use of artificial intelligence in each of these spheres will have a multiplier effect and efficiency and productivity. There are also drawbacks there, and specialists know it fully well. The fact is that it's all based on processing of major data sets, big data. Here comes personal data of people, that's number one, and naturally we need to take steps to guarantee safety and protection, to guarantee human rights in the widest sense of the world. But here is yet another very important thing, is that the people who have these databases, in essence, they can use the capacity of AI and of these technologies, they can shape the worldview of people.
But you're talking about health also, and you just spoke about health, so there was a hot mic moment between you and President Xi Jinping, and it was reported very widely when you spoke about longevity, the strides in medicine, biohacking. Do you think immortality is achievable?
Everything has an end. Only God is eternal. We can extend the longevity of life, of course. No. 77 years ago, the average lifespan of a person in India was 31 years, and now it's about 70. That's what healthcare can do. In India, child deaths were cut by fourfold. That's a result, and I can only congratulate you with it. These are all the results of the work of healthcare, and if we use AI in healthcare and to use it to produce medical drugs, for example, as they're using genetic engineering and so on, that means it would have a tremendous effect. Nevertheless, everything comes to an end.
Not hinting at your age, sir, but there have recently been a lot of Gen Z protests across the world. How do you connect with the young generation? And we have a lot of leaders now who are looking younger and younger and younger. How does this happen? And how do you connect with the young people in Russia?
You know, there is nothing new here. In literature and in art, this topic of contradiction of the older generation and the younger generation of fathers and sons in our classic literature, these images have always existed, the fathers and sons. There is nothing new here. You know what's new? The technology. These messengers, telegram, and so on, they are being used to influence the youth, the younger generation. and this generation is more or less the same. Young people are always more mobile, more radical. The younger people, a young person, thinks that they're coming across with this injustice and so on, and no one saw it before them, apparently. And now they saw that, and they will tell it to everyone around. And they think that these injustices are very easy to deal with. They can be easily solved. And when the person becomes more mature and is trying to change something himself, it turns out that they start to understand that it's possible to find a solution, but it's not as easy as it seemed at a first glance. Therefore, we need to work with people. We can't just say that you're just young, you don't understand anything, you're just sitting there in your homes, and it can't be like that. You need to always keep in touch with young people and to use their tools, their means of bringing information to them, to use feedback in social networks and so on, in social media. You need to work there, and I'm sure that you're partly doing that. I'd like to wish you every success.
We could have gone on for another hour or so, but we're reaching the fag end of our interaction with you. You just mentioned religion a while ago and the Orthodox Church, a very important aspect. I've traveled to Moscow a few times now, and every time you come here during Christmas, it is unbelievably lit. It's unbelievable to see how beautiful Moscow as a city looks. Anjana's first time. So she was surprised. It's better than any European city. But religion does play a very important role now. How do you see spirituality when it comes to the morality question in leadership, the Russian society, and for you personally?
Well, that's the foundation. In the past years, we're always turning to our traditional values, as we call them. It doesn't mean that we use these traditional values to just sit idly, but this is simply the foundation that we feel very solid on. But we need to look forward, naturally. We need to develop and use all modern means of development. And only with that, using our basic foundational values and the vision of the future, that's the only way to efficiently achieve the goals that we're setting for ourselves. And that's the way we word our goals, the goal of national development. And I would really like that the goals of our national development and the goals of India, shaped by government of India, headed by Prime Minister Modi, I really hope that they coincide with each other, so we could join efforts and achieve maximum result.
We welcome you with open hearts to India, and we look forward to whatever comes out of the meetings. But I don't know how much of Hindi films or songs you've ever heard. There's an old song that was very popular in Russia, Sar pe lal topi rusi, fir bhi dil hai Hindustani, which actually just means that there's a red cap on the head.
You're wearing a red Russian hat.
Russian hat, but the heart is Indian. And it was very popular even in Russia. A lot of people knew about it. Anything that you want to say to about India, Indian society, Indian culture, and what is your message to all Indians who like you a lot and who would want to listen to what Mr. Putin has to say to Indians?
You've just mentioned the Indian culture, about the Russian culture. You know, I think that we have a lot of citizens in the Russian Federation also have a notion about the Indian culture as about a fairy tale, a beautiful, bright, with many images, a colorful fairy tale. And from the times of the Soviet Union, people really like Indian music and Indian movies. I would even say certain parts of Russian community has make a cult of the Indian culture, and I like that very much, because I think that it's called from heart to heart. And we'll be doing everything in our power so that interest would not lose its spark. And I would like India to know that.
We are very thankful to you for this very open interview that we had with you. And the best part, I think, Geeta, out of this entire interview is that we touched everything we talked about. Everything. But this is a bond. The Indo-Russian bond is a friendship that is to be cherished forever. There are seasonal friendships, but there are friendships that last a lifetime. It is a classic vintage, and let's see what comes out of it. We're very thankful to you for this interview.
Well, that's Vladimir Putin for you, a no-holds-barred interview with Aajtak and India Today Network, where he summed up what Russia is. He's saying Russia will not be isolated, will not compromise on her interests, and is not going to go kowtow to the developed world, saying we want to be part of any grouping such as the G8. Thank you so much for joining us. India and the world was watching you.
Thank you so much, sir.
Спасибо вам.
Thank you.